and welcome back to another episode of The Damage Report, where we've got so much that we're gonna be talking about. Chuck Todd continues to not get this whole politics thing or how elections work, but I'm gonna continue my quest to get him up to speed on this, considering, well, it looks like he wants his career to be in the news, and I want people to be prepared for their job. So we're gonna tell him a little bit about how elections work. Let's see, we're gonna have a little bit of a look at the plight of the humble QAnoner on social media. It's gonna be weird, buckle up. We've got news from around the world and meanwhile in, and Mike Bloomberg, he is just, he has crafted some past for himself when it comes to sort of trying to figure out who he is. We're gonna be fleshing that out a little bit. But importantly, before all of those stories, we've also got Sean King, who's gonna be joining us to talk about his research into Joe Biden. Some of the claims that he's made about his time in the civil rights movement, his talk about that whole period. Turns out Biden has been sort of stretching the truth a bit, we'll say. And so Sean is gonna be joining us to break that down. But you know what, we got so much, why don't we just jump right into it. Today is a sad day in the news in general, but particularly here at The Damage Report. And it involves us losing someone. Can we actually put up a picture? I wanna give you an idea of what I'm talking about here. So that is Sophie. So Sophie is a producer here on The Damage Report and has been for what feels like the entire time we've had a show. And she is going to be moving on. This is her last day here, but you see there the message from some of her coworkers on the show. And it's really depressing. I'm not joking, I'm not exaggerating. We're losing a big part of sort of what The Damage Report has been. Like, you see me on the show, maybe JR and, you know, like Brett and everything, and you think that's the show, but that's like just a tiny bit of the show. It's like an iceberg. And for a very long time, Sophie has been not just like a hard, reliable worker who makes sure that the show happens, that we have the cool B-roll that we have the guests actually here, that it all works. She's running the show literally right now in the control room, but also making sure that the show is continually improving, that we don't stagnate, that we challenge ourselves, and that we don't like drive ourselves into a black hole of depression over the state of the news. And it sucks that we're losing that. She's been so awesome. I don't know what the show would look like if she wasn't here. I know we, just sort of inside baseball, we got some really good news about the performance of this show recently, and we've been doing really, really well. And like the best sitcoms, I feel like Sophie is sort of going out on top. Hopefully we'll continue to go up, but at least as of right now, like, she didn't wait until I, you know, become a parody of myself and jump the shark. She's going out on top, and we're at that top in large part due to her. So Sophie, thank you so much for everything that you've done. And I believe that Brett Ehrlich is in the studio as well.
We have a very specific celebration planned for Sophie. And by that, I mean, I'll plan it between now and when we shoot for later. But also on behalf of Angel, I'm gonna read Angel, who has a lot of responsibilities right now. She wants to say to Sophie, thank you so much for everything. You're not only a mentor, but you're my life coach. And we're really appreciative. Watch Happy Half Hour for more alcohol themed thank yous to Sophie. But Sophie and I started on back on Pop Trigger back in the day, and she has always, since even way back then, been utterly indispensable and a true joy to work with. So thank you, Sophie. And get the hell out of here.
No, yes, get out. We never loved you, just go. No, she's awesome. She's gonna do amazingly in her next the next move in her career. And so, you know, just thank you, Sophie. Really sucks to lose you, but we are excited for you. So thank you. And by the way, as just a reminder too, like, she's an amazing example of this, but just bear in mind how many people it takes to make a show like this. Like, you know how like sometimes I'll look at the right camera and sometimes I don't at the start of a thing? Like, the only reason I ever get it right is because of Edwin or whoever else is stage managing. It points to the camera right before we start. Like, I don't write these. Like, you think I don't write them. When they're funny, it ain't because of me. Like, when like the show is put together in a smooth way and there's smooth transitions and everything, that's the director. I don't throw to the graphics. And like, Bart has this awesome music that we come in from And now to all the breaks for, I don't even know how he chooses that. I don't know. I literally don't know what program he uses. And you know, I don't title the videos. Like, so we do the best work that we can on camera, but literally the only reason you see it at all, let alone that it is any good, is because of all the people that you don't see. And so thank you to Sophie, and thank you to everybody as well. With that, I have the opposite of a thank you for someone, and that someone is Chuck Todd. Chuck Todd is apparently new to this whole politics thing, certainly to elections and how they work and how you determine a front runner, as you'll see in this clip.
But I think Iowa and New Hampshire don't mean what Iowa and New Hampshire meant a decade ago. I think the way, and I think moving forward,
Iowa seemed to have an impact on Pete Buttigieg.
Well, did it? Because who's the front runner? Right?
Whose guy went in delegates?
But is he the front runner? He does certainly not get in the press of a front runner. And the problem is,
I don't understand how Bernie is considered a front runner. This is a guy that had more people showed up to the polls. Highest turnout ever, and his percentage went down that up.
Yeah.
His total number went down that up.
Okay, so I wanna make a few things clear because Chuck Todd has been in this thing for a long time. I don't generally watch MSNBC or CNN, and I haven't really for my life, but I have heard from people I respect over there that he was like this huge up and comer that came in and shook things up. And so there's a lot of respect for Chuck Todd. He makes a lot of money. So you might assume that if he says something, there is literally anything to it at all. And there's not. Is this as bad as a couple of days ago when he referred to the supporters of Bernie Sanders as brown shirts? Perhaps not. But it still bothers me as a person that cares about evidence and to the extent that the scientific method can be applied to politics, and I tried in my time in political science, I think that we should look to the evidence. So when he looks aghast at the idea, not that Bernie Sanders shouldn't be considered the front runner, he takes that as a given, but that he's not a front runner. He's literally not one of the people who's a front runner in this race. I find that a little bit hard to believe. And so I guess I respond by trying to find how would we know if a person was a front runner? Well, one way I think is if they win the races we have, and you know, on the popular vote, he won in Iowa. He certainly won in New Hampshire. So that's two out of two. Okay, well, those are just two states. What about looking forward to what's happening? I mean, I know 538 is saying he's likely to win like 40 plus states out of this whole thing. Okay, but that's perspective. What do people think around the country? Well, if we look to national polls, here's Real Clear Politics. That's the last five national polls, and Sanders is winning four out of the five. In some cases with 10 points, 8 points, even the 4 points is perfectly fine. And now the Real Clear Politics polling average that everybody refers to has him up an average of 4.4 points. So, he's won all of the states that we've had so far. He's leading in the national poll. Those seem like relevant facts. Oh, bear in mind, he's raised by far the most money out of candidates that are actually trying to raise money. That seems pretty significant too. What are you supposed to say at a time like this when one of the most like longstanding and well-respected people in cable news, someone that millions of people unfortunately still rely on for their perspective on how things are going, what's actually happening, they will hear that ridiculous set of arguments from someone like Chuck Todd, a person who clearly is animated not just by disinterest in Bernie Sanders and what he stands for, but actively disdains both himself, both Bernie Sanders and his supporters, literally referring to them as Nazis. One other little fact check, because you know we're gonna have a lot of people in this race for some time. So when Chuck Todd tells you there, from 2016 to 2020, his overall numbers went down, the percent went down. So how do you respond to that? I assume that literally even people who only get their news from MSNBC and so are fed a diet of this, immediately must respond with, there were two people competing in New Hampshire in 2016. There were more than 10 people competing this time around. There are more candidates splitting the vote, and thus the numbers for any individual candidate will go down. I mean, that's so obvious that I honestly feel crazy and a little bit stupid pointing it out, but I feel like I have to because we no longer can even have like the expectation that our well-paid, well-educated avatars of politics news can acknowledge a simple fact like when you split up a pie into more slices, each slice is gonna get a little bit smaller. Okay, well, that's my attempt to educate Chuck Todd about how this thing is going. We will continue to watch him and see if perhaps he evolves over the course of this primary. But we are gonna take a break because after this, we've got Sean King and you're not gonna wanna miss it.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called Unfucking the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of Unfucking the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be. Featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity, the UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it, "You must unlearn what you have learned." And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
Way back to his presidential runs in the 1980s, Joe Biden has at times had a bit of trouble telling the truth about who he is and what he has done. And in no area is this as clear as when he's talked about the civil rights movement and what involvement, if any, he had in it. Joining us now to break it down after doing some amazing research in this area, Sean King, activist, journalist, and founder and CEO of the North Star. Sean, welcome to the Damage Report.
Yo, good to see you, man.
Good to have you here, especially after you put together an exhaustive analysis of Joe Biden's comments about the civil rights movement and the truth there. It's two truths and 31 lies. We can't cover them all, but give us an idea of what led you on this path to do this research and some of what you found.
Man, it was actually happenstance that I even learned that he was telling these lies about participating in the civil rights movement. He started mentioning in December of last year that he had marched in the civil rights movement, that he had organized in the civil rights movement. And I had never heard that before. And I didn't know, you know, here's the thing, because there was no social media in the 1980s, the 90s, and there was hardly even social media in the 2000s when he ran for president against President Obama. Like the tools that we would have had to understand that he had been telling these lies in the 70s, the 80s, the 90s, and the 2000s, I just didn't know that history. And what most of the people who are watching us right now really didn't understand is that when Joe Biden ran for president in 1987 and 88, that his campaign really crashed and burned, not just because he was lying about the civil rights movement, but he got caught telling almost 20 different lies. He had lied about having a scholarship at law school. He had plagiarized four different speeches. He had lied about his standing in several different organizations and ultimately kind of had to come forward and fall on his sword and say, "I admit all of these mistakes." And at that point, he was not just trying to salvage his presidential campaign. He bowed out of that campaign. He was trying to salvage his political career. And one of the things that he came forward and said, and this is in 1987, is, "I never marched in the civil rights movement. I was not an organizer. I was not an activist." And this is a quote. He said, "I was a suburbanite kid and I didn't go to Selma." He had kind of lied and said he had gone to Selma and Montgomery. He had lied and said he had seen Bull Connor with his own eyes. He said, "I didn't go to Selma. I didn't go to Montgomery." He said, "I didn't go anywhere." And when I say, you know, there are two truths, that was his moment of truth. And here's the thing, Joe Biden actually has good, real, honest stories to tell about his life, but he seems to always want to add details to his biography that just aren't true. And from 1987 all the way into 2014, he never told those lies about participating in the civil rights movement again. I went back and I studied every speech he gave, every speech President Obama gave, from the Democratic conventions to when he was first chosen as VP, even to when President Obama gave him the Presidential Medal of Freedom. And you'll notice they never mention him participating in the civil rights movement. Well, at a random breakfast in 2014, Joe Biden starts telling this story again, that he marched in the civil rights movement, that he registered voters in the civil rights movement, that he participated in sit-ins at restaurants and movie theaters. And then all the way until last year, for 5 years, he never told those lies again. And last year, when he was campaigning in Iowa, into this year, when he's campaigning in Iowa and South Carolina, he starts telling these stories again, man. And it just sent me down a weird rabbit hole of beginning to understand that he has basically created a whole false narrative that he sells as if it's true, but he's already acknowledged that it's not true. The only other true statement he's ever made was that one when he stepped down from his 87 campaign, when he said, "I lied, I was never a part of the civil rights movement." In his autobiography, which I read from cover to cover, here's the thing, John, it was actually a good book. Like I actually enjoyed it and enjoyed his actual stories. He only has two sentences in his entire autobiography. It's a 400-page book about the civil rights movement. He has two sentences, and he says, "Everything I learned about the civil rights movement, I learned from watching television and listening to the radio."
Yeah.
That's all he ever says. And that was his moment of honesty, man. And here's the thing, I just wrote a book that comes out in April, and the book, my book, went through a brutal fact-checking process. And Biden, I'm sure his book did too. He knew he couldn't put those lies in his book. So he said, "Everything I learned about the civil rights movement, I learned from watching television and listening to the radio." But here he is again, 40 years after he first starts telling these lies, lying again in Iowa. And he's literally going to black churches all over South Carolina and saying a story that he's never told before, and it's a complete fabrication, that when he was a teenage boy, when he was a senior in high school, he would leave Catholic Mass and then go to different black churches for training, where they would then go out and do marches and protests and demonstrations.
Yeah.
John, I spoke to people at those churches. Joe Biden never visited those churches, and he completely made this stuff up, man. I had somebody from South Carolina who loves Joe Biden tell me, What disturbed them was, if he is knowingly telling these fabrications, it says something about his integrity. Mm-hmm. Or if he actually thinks they're true when they're not, it says something about his mental capacity. And I think it's more about his honesty. I think he's had a lifelong problem telling the truth.
Yeah.
And it's why, if you see his speeches here over the past couple of weeks, his campaign has put him on a teleprompter. He's now passing out pamphlets to people when they ask him questions instead of actually answering them. So I just think he has a struggle telling the truth about this area of his life.
Yeah, and I think it's likely that we probably agree, if it is a fabrication, if it's not just, you know, he suddenly has started believing it again after 20 years. I think we probably agree on why he's doing that opportunistically as he's campaigning across the South. What I'm curious about is, you did all this research. It's very clear, like the quote back in the 80s is very clear where he disavowed it. The quote from the book, incredibly clear. This is not like theory crafting. This is very clear, and yet the media seems entirely disinterested in this, which what seems like it would be in any other case, a massive scandal. I like to play a game where I ask, what if Bernie did this? Yeah. I think that they would make some time to cover it, and yet they don't seem interested in this. Why do you think that is?
Well, I thought they would, actually. And, you know, every time I want to believe that the mainstream media is going to do better, they always always teach me otherwise. I mean, I wrote it in 10,000 words. I mean, I have almost 100 different sources in the story that I wrote. Our team went to Delaware and interviewed people in Delaware. We went to the Delaware Historic Society. You won't find a person on earth who will tell you that they marched or did sit-ins with Joe Biden when he was a senior in high school, that he went to a black church for training. It's a complete fabrication. It seems like the media is going to give him a pass. I think because they're afraid to damage him in the election. It's just their political preference in a way. But it's unthinkable that we're trying to defeat somebody in Donald Trump who is a known liar, who's told nearly 20,000 lies since he's been elected. How can we put somebody up against him who also has that same problem? And it's part of why I've tried to really be a supporter of Bernie Sanders, is because Bernie is the antidote to Donald Trump. He's the antithesis of Donald Trump. And Joe Biden, he's going to get slammed on these lies if he ever makes it to go against Trump. I don't think Biden will make it. I think people in South Carolina, they're seeing it, even though it's not in the mainstream media. Even just the people that have written me. He spoke at a church, Bethlehem Baptist Church in Columbia, South Carolina. I had several members from that church who reached out to me to tell me how hurt they were, because this is a Sunday morning and he's looking them right in the face and telling them things that he did in the civil rights movement. And they were very touched by it, only to find out it's a complete fabrication.
Yeah.
Like, you're right though, John, it should be a scandal that tanks his campaign. I don't think I've seen a single mainstream media reporter even challenge him on it.
I haven't seen a question at a debate. I haven't seen Chuck Todd bring it up on a panel. I haven't seen anything like that. Right. And so the mainstream media is apparently, you did your work. Mainstream media is disinterested. Independent media will cover it, but we don't necessarily reach everybody. So like, as the third option, is this on the candidates? Should they be making ads, sort of mashing up what he said and what the truth is? Or do they risk, I don't know, looking bad in some way for calling into question something that people have very serious and deeply held beliefs about that time?
I know, I think candidates should pick it up. Like, I think it gets to his integrity in that regard. Like, in South Carolina, I would not be surprised if Tom Steyer picks it up, if other campaigns that are trying to challenge Joe Biden in competitive places. Yeah, I do think even Bernie's campaign should pick this up and just say, listen, this is just fundamentally not true, and that he continues to tell it. It's one thing if we were just talking, John, about him telling these lies in the 70s or 80s. It's still relevant. But he's telling those lies on the campaign trail, yeah, at campaign events this year. And so, no, I wish campaigns would pick it up. You know, my goal was just to put it out there and allow people to see the truth for themselves. Of course, I stand by it. And as you'll see, his campaign has not denied it, and they can't deny it. I mean, it's an undeniable thing that is so well sourced. You know, he even mentioned it again at a campaign event last week. And I thought that my report would stop him from doing it. But anytime he is off the script, he tells these lies, man. It's disturbing.
Wow. And everybody watching this, if you want far more information, as Sean was saying, from 100 different sources, it's 2 Truths and 31 Lies Joe Biden has told about his work in the civil rights movement. Sean King, thank you so much for taking time out to join us today. We really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you, man. Take care.
You too. We're gonna take a short break here. When we come back, Mike Bloomberg has some troubles of his own. Let's take a look at his record after this. I found a new game that I like to play. Maybe you'll enjoy it too. It's this fun game where I defy you to go back and find a quote or a video, an interview with Mike Bloomberg from more than 6 months ago and not find something that should be disqualifying for a person trying to become the Democratic nominee for the presidency. It's so easy, in fact, that it's really frustrating that the media hasn't really picked up on any of this yet. They seem not really that interested in his candidacy, but sometimes that would actually be an improvement on what we get, because sometimes the coverage is very weird. So I want you to take a look at this tweet that I saw on my feed. So it says, Mike Bloomberg seeks to move past stop and frisk controversy. And like, as soon as I saw it, I knew that there is something wrong with that. So, you know, like, I focused in a little bit. Let's take a look at that. And you see, wait, hold on. Can you zoom a bit more and try to clean that up? Bloomberg, they wrote it? But no, honestly, like, so Bloomberg Politics believes he seeks to move past the stop and frisk controversy. Okay, so you're a news outlet. Like, why are you just saying what he wants? I mean, I know why you're just saying what he wants. Everybody watching this knows why you're just saying what he wants. But this is not your job. It's not even, by the way, the policy. Supposedly, when he launched his run, they were gonna like not cover the candidates so as to not be biased. Personally, I would say refusing to do any sort of authentic journalism on the candidates, even in areas where they have been awful, like with Mike Bloomberg, is not being neutral. It's sort of being supportive of a guy with a whole bunch of landmines in his political past. But it's just absurd that they're effectively just putting his press release in tweet form for him and sending it out there and hoping that people don't realize it. But it's in the Twitter name, man. That's not gonna work. And look, the stop and frisk thing is a massive controversy, and we've talked about it on the show before. We're gonna continue to because of how bad it was. But like, videos are popping up left and right. So here's one. We talked about it a little bit on the post game of the main show yesterday. Take a look at what he had to say about who is to blame for that financial collapse of a decade ago.
How did we get here? What are the root causes of the crisis?
You can go back. I would say it probably all started back when there was a lot of pressure on banks to make loans to everyone. Redlining, if you remember, was the term where banks took whole neighborhoods and said, people in these neighborhoods are poor, they're not going to be able to pay off their mortgages, tell them your salesmen don't go into those areas. And then Congress got involved, as local elected officials as well, and said, oh, that's not fair, these people should be able to get credit. And once you started pushing in that direction, banks started making more and more loans where the credit of the person buying the house wasn't as good as you would like. Now, it's not so bad when the market for houses keeps going up, because the nice thing about making a mortgage loan is it's very secure. After all, if the borrower defaults, you simply sell the house and you have something that's worth more than the value of the mortgage. And that assumes that real estate prices never go down, and we just discovered that they could.
So that video that you just saw is, on the one hand, amazing for how horrible it is on multiple levels, which I'll break down. And then on the other hand, it is the most normal sort of Bloomberg thing that you're gonna see. You've seen a few videos like it already since he launched his run. You're gonna see more every week until he eventually is destroyed in this race. Hopefully in the primary. Hopefully he doesn't become the nominee and then get absolutely destroyed by Donald Trump over stuff like this. But just really fast, because I did talk about it on that other show. That's not why the system fell apart, not at all. It's also conveniently victim blaming, saying that the people who were abused and victimized and deceived in the run up to the collapse and were the only ones to actually suffer after the system fell apart, that they're the ones to blame, not the people who were profiting off of this along the way and then got a convenient bailout and they're doing just fine. So that's convenient. Also, it's insane that he said that redlining was a policy intended to discriminate against poor people. Yes, it did discriminate against poor people, but they were poor non-white people. That was the whole idea. And he either doesn't know that or doesn't want you to understand that, and neither of those is acceptable. And again, you're gonna see this stuff more and more from places like the Damage Report. Hopefully at some point you'll see it on CNN and MSNBC, but thus far they seem incredibly disinterested in this stuff. Even though we don't have like a big team of researchers or anything. We have a few people who do this. Like you can literally just Google Mike Bloomberg, enter a year, you know, before 2014 and come up with things like this. Did you know that in his mayoral run in New York City, he quietly left for mostly white clubs? And if you read that article, he was in clubs that didn't allow women to be part of them. Some that were mostly white in that it was a white club. Like you had to be white or Jewish to be in there and that's it. And he only left it when he decided to run for mayor and realized that that was gonna look really bad. So we're talking like 2001 he left those clubs. That seems like something that the media might wanna talk about. But also importantly, he's gonna be going up against potentially, if he's the nominee, Donald Trump, who's gonna run his same sort of fake populist campaign that he always does. How do you feel about having a champion going up against him who says things like this? So back in 2012, City Council Speaker Christine Quinn, this is when he's mayor, announced that negotiations were finally complete on a living wage bill that would require some recipients of large economic development subsidies to pay their employees at least $10 an hour. So it's a living wage bill, but quite a limited one. You'd only be paid $10 an hour and only for companies that are being showered with money from the city. So in exchange for all of this money that we're gonna give you, we expect that you pay people in New York City $10 an hour, which arguably is not a living wage. But that's what they were gonna work on. What did the mayor think? Oh, this is great. I mean, we're giving them a bunch of money. At the very least, things can be better for the people who put me in office. No, he said, it's interesting if you think about it. The last time we really had a big managed economy was in the USSR, and that didn't work out so well. It would be great if all jobs in the city paid a lot of money and had great benefits for the workers, not good for the employers. But if you force that, you will just drive businesses out of the city. So he would love it, hypothetically, if people got paid a lot. Remember, it was $10 an hour. And he refers to that as some sort of like fantasy land dream of everybody making $1 million a year. And he says, well, look, you could have it be good for the workers, you could have it be good for the employers. I'm being very clear about where my loyalties lie. And you've heard all this talk about socialism and all that, like demonizing of it. Now, the thing that they're attacking is like a fundamental restructuring of how healthcare is provided and financed. It's a big thing. He was using that card on a $10 wage for some employers in one city in exchange for millions or billions of dollars. Okay? That's the guy that's gonna go up against Donald Trump, who's gonna run against a fake populist. You feel comfortable? I don't, especially because the media so far doesn't care about any of this stuff. This is the product of like an hour of research that I did. I popped up these things, and I'm gonna find more tomorrow. We'll talk about them then. Okay, with that, we're gonna take a short break, though, lots more to get to. It seems crazy, but the whole QAnon thing is still, it's still going on. It's still out there. There are still people, I don't wanna exaggerate, it's not a significant number of people, but there are thousands, if not tens of thousands of people who fully are convinced that there is a person embedded in government, which might be Donald Trump, who was working with Robert Mueller to out a national like league of pedophiles who's been operating for hundreds of years. In fact, like John F. Kennedy was involved or is still involved. And they still believe all of this, despite the fact that none of the predictions that the Q person online made ever came true, or that Donald Trump is viciously attacking Robert Mueller on a daily basis, even though supposedly they're like working together like the Avengers to stop this whole thing. No, it's still all out there. And I saw recently a thread of this person, Travis View, who tweeted, QAnon followers are surprisingly open about how their Q obsession has destroyed their personal relationships. And I started reading through some of the examples he gave. He quoted some people on Twitter who were QAnon fans, and it really bummed me out how deep people can get in these conspiracy theories, how it can become their identity, and they are willing to die on that hill despite years of nothing happening to justify it. And I wanna give you a few examples. One said, I've lost everyone. During my awakening, I realized my family is part of the cabal. and the hospital I worked at is cabal run. Been a rough time. Hang in there. We are pulling into the parking lot. Hashtag symbolism will be their downfall. So assuming that that is an actual person, their job is run by a cabal of pedophiles, and their family are all that cabal of pedophiles, and they now have nothing. But that's good because the parking lot is ahead. Jay Damon tweeted, join the club, brother patriot. Lost several friends myself, and family thinks I'm cuckoo for Cocoa Puffs. It doesn't help matters that this has to move at such a snail's pace. No, it really doesn't help matters. And maybe that means something that it's moving at a snail's pace, that literally years are going by with no confirmation. Another said, 2017, I pushed hard on Facebook, immediately demonized at work and at home. I didn't care, still holding the line to this day. I'll die on this hill. God bless all the others that have held the line. That's the hill you're gonna die on. That's the hill. And another person said, I'm drowning in all the unbelief. My granddaughters aren't even allowed to see me anymore, and no one in my world believes me. I'm starting to feel like I'm crazy. Something has to break on the MSM soon. I thought I was stronger than this. And like, that's probably not even a real person. And there's no reason, like, by the way, I'm not covering it right now, but people who believe QAnon have been implicated in a whole bunch of like schemes, potentially violent, all that stuff. So there's bad people in there too. But I guess, I don't know, I just have enough empathy that I look at these people and just think, man, how poorly these people have been treated by randos online, by Trump, who purposefully tries to get people embedded in this. He's amplified QAnon Twitter accounts 67 times, some multiple times. So these people who are like, they can't see their grandparents, they feel like they're going crazy because nothing has actually happened, and they still believe that this has to be true. They've been so ill-served. I just feel terrible for them. And I don't have the solution right now. We've had on cult like deprogramming experts and stuff like that. Maybe we need to do it again. But like, just attacking what they believe, I get that that's not going to convince them. Lack of evidence isn't going to convince them. But there is a human toll to this, and you're seeing it every single day on social media. These people are ruining their own lives willingly, doing terrible damage to their families as well. It just seriously bums me out. Okay, we're gonna take a short break. I'm gonna come back meanwhile. And now time for news from around the world. It's Meanwhile In. Meanwhile around the world, hey everybody, we've got a new record. Everybody get ready to celebrate. The new measured daily average concentration of CO2 in the atmosphere has hit 416.8 parts per million. Woo! That's a new record. And thank you to Greta for pointing that out. Obviously, she can be relied on to do that. A number of scientists have been tweeting about it. Most people don't care, and I get it. It's a small increase in the average parts per million of carbon concentration in the atmosphere. But that's really bad. That's not a good thing. And this is just to serve as a reminder that that is continuing to go on. And it's gonna continue throughout the year, actually. The Met Office, it's in the UK, they deal with the environment, said that, quote, the atmospheric concentration of CO2 is expected to peak above 417 parts per million in May, noting that the anticipated increase is due in part to emissions from the bushfires that have devastated large swaths of Australia since late last year. So everybody, party for 416.08, but save a little bit of liquor for 417. It's coming up soon. And just as a reminder of how significant this is, there's a chart that I remember seeing way back in the day on An Inconvenient Truth that I feel like we can't show enough, because there are still some people that don't get the connection between concentration of carbon in the atmosphere and rising temperatures. So let's bring up that famous hockey stick chart there. Yeah, so that's the 416.08. Everybody loves to say, no, it's cyclical, man. Like, things go up and things go down. Well, that's going back the bulk of a million years, and we've never seen anything like this for those million years in our atmosphere. We cannot be shocked when that has an effect on how hot things are. Meanwhile, Lynn. Meanwhile, Meanwhile, in Australia, I don't know how the kangaroos are doing, but there is good news for one animal. This animal, let's take a little picture up. You're seeing there, that is a special slug that had been feared potentially wiped out as a result of the bushfires that have been devastating Australia for literally months. To put in perspective, by the way, it's an 8-inch long slug. But researchers who've gone into some of the areas where the fires are now under control were able to find 60 of these slugs. What is really interesting about this slug in particular is that they only live on the slopes of an isolated inactive volcano in New South Wales. That's Mount Caputar. That's where they get their name. They're the Caputar slugs. They literally only live on one mountain in the entire world. And the survival of that slug comes after ecologists at the University of Sydney estimated that around 500 million animals in New South Wales, that area alone, have been affected by the bushfires. So there's a little bit of good news amongst the bad news. We do have a little bit more good news. So I've been trying to get an idea of how bad things are there. You know, we haven't seen a lot in the US news for a while. And apparently very recently there have been heavy rains in that area that have knocked back the number of active fires in the state by almost a third in just one day, from 62 active fires last night with 20 not contained to 42 with only 17 not contained. And apparently with a bit of an update into today, Australian fires are considered contained for the first time in New South Wales. So that is certainly not the end of the story. And the thing about fires like this, like we have this experience here in California, it was devastating over the past, you know, 3-4 more months in Australia. There is no reason to believe that the same thing won't happen again this year. That is what is so awful. These are not isolated events. They are the natural outgrowth of the conditions we have produced. Remember that story we talked about a long time ago about the carbon concentration going up? That produces dryness and fires like this. So great news there. You know, hopefully they will stay contained, but there's probably more coming. Meanwhile, in Japan, tragic news. The first death from coronavirus has been reported in that country. The victim, who was in her 80s and whose name has not been released, apparently lived near Tokyo. And look, that on an individual level is so tragic. This is an 80 plus year old woman who was just affected by this thing that she had nothing to do with. And that's so sad. Her death is actually the third from the coronavirus outside of mainland China. There was one individual who died in the Philippines, one in Hong Kong. That Japanese woman, by the way, had no record of travel to mainland China. And she's a woman in her 80s. It seems pretty likely that she wasn't doing a lot of globetrotting, but it stretches out and it hits people in multiple countries. Japan says that there are dozens of new cases that have been confirmed there, including 44 more on a cruise ship quarantined off of Yokohama. And so, look, that's Japan. They've had their first death. There are a number of cases. China says it's confirmed 15,152 new cases, and there have been 254 additional deaths. I mean, that is just amazing. And look, I understand we can't be alarmist. I mean, when it's a new disease spreading around the world, we should be relatively alarmist. Look, people die from the flu. I get it. There are a number of diseases that kill many people. And when you put it in perspective of, you know, how many pollution kills from cardiovascular disease, those sorts of things, yes, the numbers are small. But they're tragedies, not only on an individual level for each of these people and their families and the communities that have been affected by it, but the possibility that it's going to continue to spread. There has been good news. I'm not discounting that, but it is spreading. Take a look at this. This is sort of almost a heat map, effectively, of where there have been cases. And you're seeing there, I mean, so many there in China, nearly 50,000 reported. You've got a number in countries throughout the region, Malaysia and Thailand, India has a few, South Korea with 28, 200 plus total there in Japan, they're apparently saying. And that's that region. But again, with the way that transportation works, let's take a look at the world map. And you're gonna see there, small numbers in some of these places, Australia at 15, Russia's got 2, and apparently there were people who were quarantined in Russia that were breaking out of the hospitals they were being kept in. But Canada and the United States as well, I believe there's at least 8 cases inside of just California, where we're broadcasting from. Now, compared to some other diseases, these aren't yet, you know, like end of the world numbers or anything like that. But a lot of people are really curious to see how fast the work on these vaccines is going to be done, how quickly they can be deployed, how much information we can really trust out of what's coming out of China. The numbers that they're admitting are really bad. There's the possibility that the actual situation is even worse. And just to go a little bit in the United States, there are 14 cases. There's a 35-year-old man in Washington State recently, a couple in their 60s in Chicago, and like I said, 8 in California. So this is worldwide, from individuals who have now died in Japan to right in our neck of the woods. It's a big story, and we are going to continue to keep tabs on it. And so with that, thank you to everybody who joined us for the show. Sophie, really sad. Thank you for all your service. Really do appreciate it. And I'll be on the main show. I'll see you then.
Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.